make a start there, and let me say you are so, so welcome with us, and how glad I am that you've come to join us this evening. My name is Kev Murdoch. I'm the minister of Euston Church, and we're thrilled to have you join us for the first of what is a series of talks this week, looking at various questions about what good is God. Tonight, our subject is what good is God in a world of injustice? So, just to tell you what the format of the evening is going to be so that you know where we're going, we're going to have an interview for the next chunk of the evening up to around 8 o'clock. Then I'll do a short talk where we'll open up Luke's Gospel, one of the eyewitness accounts of the life of Jesus, just for a few minutes. And then we'll have a Q&A, so that will be your opportunity to come back on anything that's been said, either in the interview time or in the Bible talk, or anything else that you would like to ask or comment on around the subject that we're looking at this evening. Up on the screen in a moment, I think you're going to see a QR code that will be really helpful for you for this evening. So if you go into that QR code, pigeonhole.at, that's where we'll collate your questions. They're all anonymous, so if you type them in via your phone, they will then appear anonymously in that Pigeonhole app. And for the last chunk of the evening, we'll go through those. You can vote up other people's questions, so it's very democratic. If you want to vote up a question that someone else has written, then you can click on to do that, and we'll go through a bunch of those questions at the end. I haven't introduced our special guest this evening, Sir Jeremy Cook. Let's wish him a warm welcome.
Thank you.
Jeremy, thank you for coming. I know you're a busy man. You've been busy today. What have you been doing today?
I've been sitting in an arbitration about distortion of the steel market.
Okay, well, you can ask about that in the Q&A if you'd like to know more about the steel market. Hey, I've done my research on you with the help of Wikipedia. Did you know you're on Wikipedia?
My granddaughter tried to put an entry to Wikipedia saying that she was the best member of the family.
Oh,
they,
right.
They rejected it.
Fantastic. Well, it says, Sir Jeremy Cook, it says your age, I won't say what that is. The Honourable Mr. Justice Cook is a former judge at the Queen's Bench in the High Court from 2001. Presiding judge for the Southeastern Circuit from 2007 to 11 and judge in charge of the Commercial Court from 2012 to 16. Is that right? I know they don't always get it right on Wikipedia.
Give or take.
Give or take. Okay. Yeah, well, there enough. You go. So that's who you are. Did you always want to be a lawyer?
No.
Sir Jeremy? No?
No.
What prompted the interest?
Well, like many people of my generation, getting jobs wasn't really an issue. You went to university if you qualified sufficiently, and the question was, what do I read at university? I knew I didn't want to be a school teacher, so that ruled out quite a lot of academic subjects. My father was a lawyer, and I thought, well, law's as good as anything. I'll give that a crack, see what happens. Because you can go into business with it, you can do all sorts of things with it. And it was essentially only in the last year that I developed any interest, which is probably because that was the first time I did any work.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've got a bit of a background in law myself.
So yeah, I knew that.
Didn't quite make it to judge. Barely made it past trainee solicitor, to be honest. But the thing I do remember is the famous case that all students remember, Donoghue and Stevenson.
Oh,
any
yes.
Lawyers here remember that one? The famous case, someone whooped. They think it's so exciting. One of those famous cases.
Scott's case.
It was, yeah. And I thought we'd better just test you on it just to check that you remember some of the details. So Donoghue and Stevenson, do you remember what year?
1931?
Well, 32 was 32. The case, but they probably happened in 31, that means,
right.
Doesn't it?
It's thereabouts. Yeah.
Where?
Well, it must have been in Scotland because it was McAllister against Stevenson originally, wasn't it?
Yes, it was in Paisley, a little town just outside
right,
Glasgow.
Yes. Ginger beer bottle.
I was going to say, what happened? Do you remember what happened?
Because someone went to a cafe and they bought a bottle of ginger beer. And what did they find at the bottom after they poured out the contents but a snail? And so they sued the manufacturer.
And tell us why that was a landmark case.
Well, it was a landmark because there was no contract between the manufacturer of the ginger beer and the consumer. So they might have sued the people who'd supplied it in the restaurant, but actually they decided, self-evidently, the restaurant was unlikely to be to blame for putting a snail in the ginger beer bottle. So they sued the manufacturer.
Yeah. Now, did you know this, though, that I discovered later? They reckon that it wasn't a snail.
Oh, really?
They reckon that something congealed at the bottom of the ginger beer. And so the snail that changed the world wasn't actually a snail. So,
well, there we are.
Yeah. But that area is not your speciality. You were a barrister and then in the High Court. What was your speciality?
Well, as a barrister, I did commercial work. So I did a lot of shipping and insurance and banking and international trade and that sort of thing. But there comes a point where they expect you to do your bit for the country and act as a part-time judge. So amidst your practice as a barrister, you go off and you sit in Crown Courts and do a bit of crime. So I used to go down to Sussex mostly, but sometimes the inner London courts, and usually I would try pub fights.
Oh, wow.
That's the usual thing.
Yeah. Now, and Wikipedia said that you've done some interesting ones, though. There was something about some cricketers, something about duel.
Well, when I was appointed a High Court judge, you then have to do whatever they tell you to do, basically. So whether you know anything about it or not, you get sent off to do serious crime. So I'd done small-time crime, and then as a High Court judge, you get sent off basically to do murders. We always talk about doing murders, but you understand what I mean.
Right.
You try murders rather than do murders. So I've done a lot of trials of murders. And one of the cases, which those of you who are law students may know, it's quite a well-known case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I'll tell you just the story very briefly, because it's a rather frightening story in its way. You've got a couple of lads, 19-year-olds or thereabouts, and they live in southeast London, UCOS, and one disses the other. They belong to rival gangs, and they arrange to meet in the car park of a block of flats and have a shootout. And one of them literally turns up with a hat on his head and a bandana around his face, so you couldn't see who he was. And he's up on the top of a bank, whilst the other lad is down in the car park running between cars, and they're taking pot shots at one another as things develop. And just at that moment, there is a Polish girl on the phone to home, walking by. She's a nurse. She's on the way back from hospital. And as they fire at one another, the man up on the top, wearing the bandana and the hat, shoots, misses the person he's aiming at, and kills the nurse. I mean, imagine that. She's on her phone to her sister hears this terrible thing. And the big question is, because they couldn't identify who the man was who'd fired the shot, they prosecute the other lad, and they want to prosecute him for murder. And I ask you the question, can that be right? The chap down below, he's been firing at the man up on the top of the slope. He's not the one who causes the death. It's the other one who causes the death, but he gets prosecuted for murder. So hands up, how many of you think he's guilty of murder? Not a soul. That's where I started from. And I finished up, it's a point of law, finished up actually saying he could be guilty of murder under a theory that if you're involved deliberately in an unlawful act and you foresee the consequence of it as being the death of someone else, you can be guilty of murder. And they'd arranged to meet to have a duel. So it's obviously they were foreseeing the death of somebody else. Anyway, I so ruled, and the jury went and heard the case and convicted him. And the case then went to the Court of Appeal, and they got a special Court of Appeal because they thought this was rather significant. So they had five judges who all said, Cook, you've got it completely wrong. Hopeless. Then it goes up to the Supreme Court, where they have nine judges instead of the normal five. And they say, Cook, you've got it right, but for entirely the wrong reasons.
Okay.
So there you are. It's a case called Ganango, if you want to look it up, but it's quite interesting from a point of
view. Yeah, and I mean, what a thing that these guys had agreed to go and have a duel like that. You get us into something I want to pick up later on, really the human condition and what we're like. But let's rewind for a bit. Just take us back to your childhood. What sort of family home did you grow up in?
Well, I mentioned my father was a solicitor. I was one of three boys. I was the middle of three. It was a Christian home. So I was always brought up to read the Bible and knew essentially what it was about. Very happy home.
Yeah.
I appreciated my parents most of the time. Yeah.
So faith was part of family life.
It was.
When was that something that you really started to own as your own faith?
Well, I guess, as is common with youngsters, you get to the age of about 14 or 15 and you suddenly stop and think, is this really true? And if it is, does it matter? And one goes through that sort of teenage angst thing. You know, what is life about? And I think I was, in a sense, quite, in all modesty, quite mature in thinking through these issues. I'd read quite a bit of philosophy, and it just seemed to me that, you know, life was completely meaningless. It was nonsensical. On what earth was the point, unless there was some purpose that lay behind it, and a God who had created the order in which we live, we see all around us in the universe. And when I stopped and thought about Jesus in particular, it came to me, well, actually, if he is who he says he is, then actually nothing else matters except following him. And so at about the age of 14 or 15, I guess it was nothing very dramatic. It took place over a period of probably a year or so, perhaps 2 years, when I said, well, I've got to make this my own. I've got to live this out. And there were two things, I think, probably, that drove me to that conclusion. The first was realizing that if it's true, nothing else is as important. And the second thing was seeing a few people who were a few years older living out the Christian life. And I could see the authenticity of the way they lived, how it impacted on their lives. And so it was both a question of truth and a question of attractiveness, because I could see that it worked for these people. They lived it out.
What impresses you about Jesus Christ as you see him in Scripture?
I don't think I'd ever been asked that question before. I think from a personal angle, it's just the fact that I can see looking back how he's led me and not let me go. And there have been times when I've been disobedient, times when I've not lived the way I should, and yet he's kept hold of me. And it's simply the fact that nothing else really makes sense unless you give your life to him and really mean it.
Yeah.
So that he said to Peter once, are you going to leave as well when all these other people left? And Peter said, to whom else would we go? You have the words of eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I see it.
Yeah. Can we talk about evidence for a bit? Talk, obviously, evidence and examining the facts is a big part of your job. You believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. You're someone who's been to Oxford University. You're a high court judge, not someone who wants to leave your brain at the door when it comes to faith. Why do you believe that? And as I say, bodily, you don't just think the spirit of Jesus lives on like the spirit of Elvis or whatever. Why do you believe that?
Well, because I think the evidence is very compelling if you look at it. There are plenty of lawyers who've written books about it, and I can recommend them to you if you'd like to do that. Look at it for yourself. But if you take the records, as we have them, of eyewitnesses who were there, and then work out, now, what is the most logical and most coherent explanation for everything that happened? In the end, I think you come to one clear conclusion, which is that the resurrection of Jesus really did happen. It's the only thing that truly fits. And just to give you a foretaste, at the time, there were only two versions of events that anybody thought were plausible. The first was that the disciples had stolen his body. And that was the story that the Jewish authorities put out. And if you read debates even as late as 165 AD, there's a famous debate between a Jew and a Christian. You find that's the Jewish line that was still being pursued. His disciples came and stole the body. And yet when you examine that, it just isn't feasible in the context of guards around the tomb and all the rest of it. And the fact that the disciples themselves went on to live out a life following Jesus and prepared to die for it. read it for yourself. And the only other explanation is that actually he did rise from the dead and he appeared to all these people. And one of the things I often do when I'm giving talks to kids at Easter is to eat a daffodil. This may seem slightly strange. You want to explain why I eat a daffodil? And I say to the kids, I say, if you go home and you tell your dad, the man up the front in the church, he just ate a daffodil. Don't be silly. Don't be silly. But then I said, if you and your sister went home and said that, he'd begin to wonder. And then if another dozen people turned up who all said the same thing, you think there's something to it. And if 500 people turned up and said the same thing, you'd realize there's something here that I've got to look at. And evidence is, after all, at the end of the day, simply people saying what they saw, heard, or experienced. That's what evidence is. And so what we have in the New Testament is evidence. And we know of a time when Jesus appeared to 500 people. Paul lists a whole lot of witnesses. Plenty of books on it. There's a great book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, if you really want to get into it in a big way. But it's very compelling.
And so you'd say read it as if they're witnesses and just see what you make of the evidence.
Yeah. Indeed.
Fantastic. Okay, let's move on. Let's think a bit about human nature. You started to get us thinking about that. I was wondering, do you, in those kind of criminal cases that you mentioned earlier, do you ever feel sorry for the people that you're having to pronounce a sentence on?
Yes. Yes. I can think of two particular people. One was a lad who, he lived with a girl who'd had a baby and he was left to look after the baby. When she went out, he was 18, thereabouts. And of course, the baby screamed and wouldn't stop screaming. And anybody who's lived with a child, they can't stop screaming, knows how easy it is to get frustrated. He wasn't very mature, and he picked up the baby and whacked its head and killed it. And you looked at this lad and you thought, well, I can understand how someone could just lose it completely. And he did, and terrible consequences. So that's one example. Another example is a man whose wife behaved incredibly badly towards him. He was going to walk out with the kids and taunted him and mocked him, and he lost it, and he strangled her in a moment of temper. And again, you know, have you ever lost your temper? You can understand how these things happen.
Yeah.
Takes responsibility for it. They've got to take responsibility for it. But many people face much harder and more difficult situations than we do, and they succumb to temptation, and it has terrible, terrible consequences. So yes, there are people I feel sorry for.
Yeah. I mean, I don't quite know how to ask this, but when you think of real serious criminals that you've seen, would you say they are a different category of person from the rest of us?
Do you know who else asked me that question?
No.
Her Majesty the Queen.
Oh, no.
Ask me that question. I'm glad you asked me that.
Me and the Queen.
She said, are criminals different from other people? And the answer I gave was the answer I'd give to you. No, they're not. Jesus once said, he said, out of the heart comes murder and theft. And then he goes on to say hatred, anger, malice, slander, and so on. And so the problem is essentially a problem we all have. It's just it comes out in different ways. Are we living for ourselves or are we living for Jesus? And so the problem that a criminal has is pretty much the same problem that you and I have. So Jesus says on another occasion, anybody who's angry with someone else has the same root problem as the person who kills. Anybody who covets or is jealous has the same root problem as the person who steals. So, you know, that's our human condition. And the sooner we come to terms with that and recognize it, the better. And that's true of judges too. So whenever I sentence someone, I would never say, you are a despicable, evil person. Because I'm much the same. I'd say what you've done is evil and wrong, as they themselves invariably recognize. And that's why we're dealing with you the way you are. But the judge is in no different position from anybody else.
When you see, I mean, you've seen a lot of what human beings are capable of, in a bad way. Does that ever make you question, you know, could there be a good God who allows all of this?
No, I think I'm pretty realistic about people. You will have gathered from what I've just said that I think we all have this basic problem that we need to grapple with, or indeed need to allow God to grapple with. In terms of human nature being what it is, people are both capable of remarkable altruism and terrific acts of unselfishness. You know that, you've seen that. At the same time, they're capable of the most gross and terrible acts as we see it that have awful consequences. But if you ask, well, how does that impact on a God? The question you have to ask, what best explains the human condition as we know it? What best explains the fact that we have this tendency to do evil, but at the same time a clear recognition that there is such thing as justice, that good matters, that loving other people is important, values of this kind? And the explanation that Christianity gives is simply that there is a good God who created us to relate to him. And mankind rejects that and brings upon himself the consequences in the evil that he does and in the world we see about us. So I don't see a problem there from that point of view.
And you started to talk about justice there. Let's talk about justice. Well, first of all, let's talk about your job in justice. How do you actually become a judge, I was wondering? I mean, I'm not thinking of applying, I just wondered.
Well, you could apply. All sorts of people can apply these days. Historically, you used to have to be a lawyer for at least a certain period of time. And historically, most of the judges used to come from the ranks of barristers. I'm pretty old-fashioned about this. I think that's a good idea because you become a judge after you've learned all the tricks of the trade that people employ in court. So you understand what's going on and what barristers are trying to achieve. And you're familiar with the setup. And so although it's a bit like a poacher turned gamekeeper, the result is you should have a good idea about human nature and about the temptations people face and the issues. When I was appointed, you didn't apply for the job. The Lord Chancellor actually would ring you up and say, we'd like you to be a judge. And you'd have actually usually not more than a few hours to say yes or no. So I recall ringing up my wife and saying, how's about it? I was fairly clear in my own mind that it was the right thing to do, but consulted my wife and we agreed. And that afternoon I went to see the Lord Chancellor and he said, well, we'll sign you up.
Yeah. And that wasn't...
Now you have to apply for it. You have to fill in forms and have interviews and all sorts of stuff.
Okay, yeah. And what does a judge actually do? I mean imagine the skill set. You must have to be good at processing lots of information, but you have to probably be good with people as well and get people.
I think there are three things, perhaps. A bit depends on the type of work you're doing. So I do a lot of commercial work, which is very heavy paper-wise, huge volumes of paper, and you need pretty strong analytical skills to deal with complex problems in commerce, both as questions of law and questions of fact. So an analytical skill is important. The second is to have a good understanding of human nature, the way people react. And that applies across the board, I think, in whatever sphere of law you operate. And the third thing, above all, is good judgment. Difficult thing to define, isn't it? But the ability to discern what's right, where the truth lies, to decide who's lying and who isn't, and so on and so forth. Mm. And that's something you acquire with a degree of training, I think.
Yeah.
I think over the years you develop that. So I personally think it's quite a good thing that our judges tend to be at the older end of the scale and have years of life experience behind them.
Exactly. And what's made you, Sir Jeremy, passionate about that as a Christian?
Well, quite simply this, that God is a God of justice. And whilst what we do in this country is pretty good by most standards in the world, it's still a rough and ready form of justice. Human justice will never be perfect. So judges get it wrong, juries get it wrong, injustice is done. But the idea that there's a God who is actually going to get it 100% right is in fact enormously comforting. as a judge, you have to take a sort of matured attitude to the Court of Appeal, who are there to put you right when you've got it wrong.
They put you right a few times, haven't they?
Only two or three times.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
And I like to think they were wrong on two of those occasions. But the fact is, of course, one can get it wrong. There are obvious examples of injustice that happen. In this country, we're very fortunate in that corruption amongst the judiciary is unknown. It would be very hard to imagine anybody ever getting to a judge and offering a bribe. In probably two-thirds of the world, that's absolutely commonplace. A bribe will be offered and you won't get justice. Unless you pay the bribe, you don't win. So we're very fortunate in this country because of the ethos that's developed over a couple of hundred years. But still, having said that, because we're human, it's fallible, and we get it wrong. But the idea there's a God who gets it absolutely right is very appealing.
Well, say more about that. What do you mean by that? What's God's judgment actually going to be like and things as you understand it?
Well, I think the easiest thing to do is to read Jesus' parables. Jesus tells story after story about God judging. In fact, he talks probably more about that than almost about anything else in his parables. And it's all about separating the wheat from the chaff, the good fish from the bad fish, faithful servants and unfaithful servants. You can read any number of them. But in the end, of course, what it comes down to is really what your response is to Jesus. Because we're all on the wrong end of justice, because we've got this basic problem that we need sorted out. And so we need Jesus both to forgive us and to make us new, to give us a fresh start and to give us his spirit to empower us to live the way he wants. And what he says very simply is this: if you live for me now, give your life to me now, then you'll be with me for eternity. But if you don't, then you're on the wrong end of justice and you've got nothing to look forward to at all. And he talks about hell in pictorial terms, but extremely unpleasant. And though one can't be very specific about the details, just as we can't be very specific about heaven, it's quite clear what he's saying. There's a division between those who follow Jesus and those who don't.
Yeah. Some of us were just on a weekend away when we were thinking about the new heavens and the new earth beyond judgment. I wonder what excites you about that. I guess lots of the things you deal with in your work won't be there.
Well, that's a good question. Will there be any lawyers in heaven?
Oh, right.
I don't know the answer to that. There won't be any crime, but that's for certain, so you won't need that. But on the other hand, there will be order and regulation, so you may have regulatory lawyers. I don't know.
Okay, there'll be something for you to do, I'm sure.
There may be something for me to do. Exactly. Who knows?
One final question before we finish this part of the evening, and it's really just a question on our piece of paper that we advertised the evening with. What good is God? How would you sum it up? What good is God, then, in a world that is so full of injustice?
He's the one hope we've got, isn't he? I mean, I look around at the mess this country's in at present, but all around the world that's absolutely full of corruption and injustice. And you say, so what hope have we got? And the only hope lies in a God who's going to change things and put things right at the end of time, which is what he says he's going to do. Jesus is going to come again. And he'll put things right, and he'll take those of us who belong to him to be with him, whatever that involves.
Yeah, thank you. So, Jeremy, thank you. This isn't the end of talking to you, but we are just going to have a couple of minutes of pause now, and it's the time with that pigeonhole. If we keep that up on the screen, then you can get that into your phone and start putting in some questions, and then in a couple of minutes' time, I'll jump up and give us a short talk from Luke's Gospel. But let's have a couple of minutes' break.